All right, so maybe you're prepping for that big mass torts case, or you're just a legal history buff. Either way, today we're diving deep into Hardy v. Johns Manville
Ooh, a classic.
from 1982, but this one still echoes in courtrooms today.
Oh, absolutely. Hardy's a staple.
Think about it. What if a court just said, "We all know asbestos is bad, so everyone who ever made it is automatically liable"?
Sounds efficient. Right.
At first, maybe. But Hardy shows us why that's a huge due process issue, especially with so many lawsuits from workers who got sick, sometimes decades after being exposed. Pinpointing blame gets really tricky.
You've got it. And that's what makes Hardy so fascinating. It throws a wrench in the system just when you think things are moving along. The district court, they were trying to manage this flood of asbestos cases, so they consolidated a bunch of them.
Makes sense, right? Lots of common issues got to streamline somehow.
Right. But then they took this shortcut using a previous case, Borel v. Fiberboard. Now, Borel established that asbestos companies, they've got a duty to warn users about the dangers.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Duty to warn. We've heard that before.
So far, so good, right? But then the court took this giant leap and said, well, everyone knows asbestos causes cancer, so all asbestos manufacturers are liable. We'll figure out the money later.
Whoa, hold on a minute. Isn't that like assuming guilt before you even prove it? What about companies that weren't even part of the Borel case?
And that's exactly what the Fifth Circuit thought. They stepped in and slammed on the brakes, saying, whoa, Borel only applied to those specific companies, not the entire industry. You can't just paint an entire industry with one brush based on one case.
Right. It's like saying because one Ford Explorer rolled over, now every SUV on the road is automatically defective.
Exactly. And the Fifth Circuit, they really hit on this due process issue. You know, they said stretching legal concepts too far in this way violates the rudimentary demands of due process. It's a pretty powerful statement.
So this isn't just about asbestos. It's about how far courts can go in using shortcuts, right?
Right.
I mean, you can't sacrifice fairness for the sake of efficiency, no matter how many cases are piling up.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Hardy v. Johns Manville, it's like a legal guardrail, reminding us that even in these massive complex cases with tons of plaintiffs, every defendant deserves their day in court.
And the Fifth Circuit didn't stop there. They had some strong words for how the district court handled the whole "everyone knows asbestos causes cancer" thing.
Yeah.
They basically said, "Hold on, that's a scientific claim, not a universal truth that a judge can just declare without any evidence."
It is, you know, judges can't just bypass the whole process of presenting evidence and proving a case.
Even when dealing with something that seems like common knowledge, it seems like that could open up a whole can of worms.
Oh, absolutely. And the Fifth Circuit, they were drawing a line in the sand, saying judges can't just decide complex scientific issues all on their own. They need the evidence, expert testimony, the whole nine yards.
Okay, wow. So judges can't just declare scientific facts, even if it seems obvious. That's a pretty big deal.
Huge. And that's why this case is still so relevant today, even decades later. It's not just about asbestos, it's about setting limits on judicial power and making sure scientific claims are properly vetted in court.
So we've got due process concerns, limits on judicial notice. What other legal landmines did the Fifth Circuit uncover in Hardy? Because they definitely weren't happy with the lower court's approach.
Oh, they weren't. And another big one they had a problem with was the whole concept of privity.
Privity. Now that sounds like a fun one.
It might sound like a stuffy legal term, but it's really important. It's like this legal connection that lets a ruling in one case impact people in another, even if they weren't directly involved in that first lawsuit.
Okay, so how did privity pop up in Hardy?
Well, the Fifth Circuit argued that the district court stretched this idea of privity way too far. By lumping all the asbestos manufacturers together based on Borel, they were basically saying any company in the industry was automatically connected to the Borel companies.
But didn't we already establish that using Borel as a blanket justification was a problem? Seems like they're just doubling down on a bad idea.
It does, doesn't it? But the Fifth Circuit was basically saying, hold on, real privity needs a much stronger connection than just being in the same industry.
Right. It's like saying because we both host podcasts, we're automatically bound by each other's contracts. The connection has to be much more direct than that.
Exactly. And legally significant. So by overextending this idea of privity, the district court was essentially saying all those non-Borel companies were guilty by association, denying them their right to a fair trial.
So we've got due process, judicial notice, and now this whole privity mess. What other legal curveballs did the Fifth Circuit have to deal with in Hardy? It seems like they were playing whack-a-mole with the district court's reasoning.
They were, and this next one is a mouthful, but stick with me, it's important. Non-mutual offensive collateral estoppel.
Okay, I might need a diagram for that one.
Mm-hmm.
What in the world is non-mutual offensive collateral estoppel?
It sounds like something out of a Harry Potter spellbook. It does sound intimidating, right? But it's actually a pretty simple idea. Imagine you win a lawsuit against a company, right? Now, someone else who was harmed by that same company wants to sue them too. They might try to use your victory to their advantage, saying, hey, the court already decided this company is liable, so they should be liable to me too, automatically. That's basically non-mutual offensive collateral estoppel using someone else's legal win as a weapon in your own case.
So it's like piggybacking on someone else's legal victory. Interesting strategy, but I could see how that could be problematic. How did this play out in Hardy?
Well, the district court used the Burrell case like a battering ram. They basically said because Burrell already decided about duty to warn, all asbestos manufacturers are automatically liable, regardless of whether they were involved in Burrell or not.
But didn't the Fifth Circuit already shut that down when they talked about privity? It seems like they're making the same mistake twice.
You're right. The privity issue and this offensive collateral estoppel issue are two sides of the same coin. The Fifth Circuit said you can't use offensive collateral estoppel unless there's a valid privity relationship. Since the district court already messed up on privity, their use of this estoppel thing was automatically invalid, like building a house on sand.
A double whammy.
Yeah.
So the misuse of privity set the stage for misusing this estoppel concept, and both moves chipped away at those defendants' right to a fair trial. It sounds like the Fifth Circuit was really trying to bring some order back to this whole situation.
Exactly. They're basically saying, we get you're trying to manage this legal tidal wave, but you can't just throw due process out the window.
This is a perfect example of how even seemingly boring legal concepts have real consequences. It's easy to get lost in the jargon, but ultimately it's about fairness. It's about justice. You can't just steamroll over individual rights because it's more efficient.
That's the heart of it. And the Fifth Circuit's analysis in Hardy, it's like a legal masterclass in how to carefully dissect a lower court's approach and explain why it went too far.
I'm seeing why this case is still so relevant today. So what else did the Fifth Circuit have to say about this whole mess? They weren't shy about calling out the district court's mistakes, but did they offer any advice on how to handle these complex cases without resorting to unfair shortcuts?
They did. One key thing they emphasized was the need to consider fairness factors before using this offensive collateral estoppel thing. They pointed to a Supreme Court case, Park Lane Hosiery Combe Shore, which basically created a checklist for courts.
Park Lane Hosiery? Okay, that rings a bell vaguely. Something about pantyhose. Can you remind us what those fairness factors were? It sounds like the Fifth Circuit was trying to give some practical guidance for handling these tough situations.
Absolutely. The Supreme Court in Park Lane, they outlined several factors for courts to consider. Things like, were the issues in the prior case clear and fully argued? Were there any inconsistencies in previous rulings on the same issue? Did the defendant really fight hard in that prior case? And could they have reasonably foreseen future lawsuits based on that case?
Wow. Okay, that's quite a list. So the Fifth Circuit was basically saying, don't just use offensive collateral estoppel without thinking. Take a step back, use this checklist, make sure it's actually fair to everyone. It seems pretty reasonable.
Right, and it shows their commitment to making sure justice isn't sacrificed for efficiency. They were saying, we got to be thoughtful, deliberate, and above all, fair when using legal tools that have such big consequences.
I'm starting to see why Hardy v. Johns Manville is still such a big deal, even for lawyers who don't handle asbestos cases. It's about setting guidelines for fairness and due process, and that matters in all sorts of litigation.
Absolutely. The Fifth Circuit's analysis in Hardy is like a compass, guiding us through the messy world of mass torts.
This deep dive is getting intense. We've already uncovered so much. Due process concerns, the limits of judicial notice, now this whole privity mess. What other legal quicksand did the Fifth Circuit find themselves in with the Hardy decision?
Oh, there's plenty more, believe me. And next, we're going to talk about something called unforeseeable liability. Now, that's a real head-scratcher.
Unforeseeable liability. All right, you've got my attention. Tell me more.
Welcome back to our deep dive into Hardy v. Johns Manville. We've been unpacking some serious legal baggage, and there's still more to uncover.
I'm ready for it. This case is like a legal thriller, full of twists and turns. What else did the Fifth Circuit have to say about how courts should handle these massive, complex lawsuits?
Well, they highlighted this tension between efficiency and individual rights. You know, it's like trying to fit a square peg in a round hole.
Oh, yeah. I remember wrestling with that in law school. How do you balance the need to resolve these cases quickly, especially when there are so many of them, with the need to ensure everyone gets a fair shot?
That's the million-dollar question, right? And the Fifth Circuit was pretty clear that courts can't just steamroll individual rights in the name of expediency. They specifically pointed to the Seventh Amendment, the right to a jury trial.
Ah, the Seventh Amendment. That's a big one. So how did that play into Hardy?
Well, they were concerned that the district court's approach, with all those shortcuts and assumptions, was basically sidestepping the Seventh Amendment. By pre-deciding so many key issues, they were denying the defendants their right to have those issues put before a jury.
So it's like the court was saying, we already know the answer, why even bother with a trial? That seems like a pretty dangerous precedent.
Exactly. The Fifth Circuit was adamant that even asbestos litigation, as complex as it is, still falls under the Seventh Amendment. You can't just toss aside the right to a jury trial because a case is complicated or involves a lot of people.
It's a good reminder that efficiency can't just trump those fundamental rights.
So we've got the Seventh Amendment issue, and we've talked about how Hardy has had this ripple effect on mass tort cases more broadly, but did it specifically change how asbestos litigation is handled? Did it lead to any practical changes in the courtroom?
It did. One of the biggest impacts was on the use of consolidation. Remember we talked about how the district court and Hardy lumped all those cases together?
Yeah.
And that's what created that whole guilt by association problem the Fifth Circuit had a problem with.
Exactly. After Hardy, courts became a lot more careful about using consolidation in asbestos cases. They realized it's not this magic bullet, and it can actually backfire pretty badly if you're not careful.
So it's like consolidation became the legal equivalent of a hand grenade, potentially powerful, but also dangerous if you're not handling it carefully.
That's a great way to put it. Hardy forced courts to get more strategic, more selective about consolidation, recognizing it's not a one-size-fits-all solution.
Did the Fifth Circuit give any specific guidance on how courts should handle consolidation going forward? I mean, they highlighted the problems, but did they offer any solutions?
They did. They stressed the importance of looking beyond just the surface similarities between cases. It's not enough to say, oh, these all involve asbestos, let's throw them in a pot and stir. You got to dig deeper, see if there are genuine factual parallels that justify consolidation.
So making sure the cases are actually similar enough to be lumped together, it's not just about saving time and resources. It's about making sure defendants aren't unfairly grouped with others who might have acted differently.
Exactly. The Fifth Circuit was essentially saying, don't just consolidate for the sake of consolidating. There needs to be a real reason, and you have to be mindful of those potential downsides.
That's a really important point. It's like they were advocating for a more nuanced and thoughtful approach to consolidation, not just blindly using it as a catch-all solution.
Exactly. It's a good reminder that the legal system isn't about just applying these rules blindly. It's about using judgment, using discretion, and always prioritizing that fairness and due process.
This is great stuff. It's clear that Hardy v. Johns Manville was a big turning point in asbestos litigation, making courts rethink their strategies and adopt this more balanced approach.
Yeah.
But did it have an impact on other types of mass tort cases as well?
Oh, it absolutely did. Hardy became a kind of legal cautionary tale, a reminder that even in these huge, complex cases, you can't just sacrifice individual rights for the sake of getting things done quickly.
A cautionary tale. Like a legal horror story that keeps judges up at night.
Exactly. It became the symbol of how important due process is, even when you're facing mountains of paperwork and pressure to resolve things fast.
So the Fifth Circuit was basically saying, hey, we get it. Mass torts are a logistical nightmare. But that's not an excuse to cut corners or forget about the rights of those individual defendants.
That's it. Exactly. And that message resonated. Courts started citing Hardy in all sorts of mass tort cases, from those product liability claims to environmental disasters, as a way to really reinforce the importance of fairness, of individual justice.
Wow. So it wasn't just limited to asbestos. It was about setting these core principles that should be guiding courts in all mass tort cases, regardless of the specific circumstances.
That's right. Hardy became a touchstone, something courts could refer back to when they were navigating this tricky area where efficiency and fairness often clash.
This is incredibly insightful. It's clear that Hardy v. Johns Manville was a pivotal moment in how mass tort litigation evolved, setting a precedent that we're still grappling with today.
It was. And it speaks to the power of judicial reasoning, you know, to guide us through these uncharted legal waters.
I'm really starting to understand why Hardy is considered such a landmark case. It's not just about asbestos. It's about the fundamental principles that underpin our legal system. And this constant push and pull between efficiency and fairness, especially in a world where litigation is only getting more complex.
Couldn't have said it better myself. We've covered a lot of ground today, from due process and judicial notice to privity, the Seventh Amendment, the challenges of consolidation. It's a lot to take in, but it's all connected.
It is. And it's fascinating. I feel like we've peeled back so many layers of this case and found all these legal insights, but I have a feeling there's even more to discover.
Oh, there's definitely more. The Fifth Circuit's analysis in Hardy is like a deep well, and we've only just started drawing water from it.
All right, well, I'm ready to quench my legal thirst. What other nuggets of wisdom did the Fifth Circuit drop in their Hardy decision? I am all ears.
Well, they made this really poignant observation about the human cost of all this. It's easy to get bogged down in the legal arguments, the procedural complexities, but at the heart of it all, are real people who've suffered real harm.
That's a powerful point. It's like the legal system is this big machine, and it's easy to forget that there are actual people whose lives are being impacted by these decisions.
Exactly. And the Fifth Circuit, even while they were really getting into the legal weeds, they never lost sight of that human element. They acknowledged how devastating asbestos-related diseases are, and the long, difficult path a lot of these plaintiffs face in their search for justice.
So it's like they were saying, yes, we have to be mindful of due process, of fairness to the defendants, but let's not forget there are real people who are hurting, who deserve our compassion.
You got it. They were reminding us that these legal battles aren't just some abstract intellectual exercise. They involve real lives, real pain, real consequences.
That's a powerful message. It seems like the Fifth Circuit was walking this tightrope in Hardy, trying to balance these competing interests, making sure justice is served for everyone involved. But did they offer any specific guidance on how to strike that balance?
They did. They stressed the importance of using those procedural tools thoughtfully, cautiously. For example, we talked about consolidation earlier. While it can be really helpful in streamlining things, they cautioned against overusing it.
Yeah, I can see why. Lumping too many cases together can end up creating this blur where the specifics, the individual circumstances, get lost.
Exactly. They warned against creating these mega trials that become so unwieldy, so huge, that it's almost impossible for defendants to present their individual defenses effectively.
So it's like consolidation is a powerful tool, but you have to use it with a surgeon's precision, not a sledgehammer.
That's a perfect analogy. The Fifth Circuit was urging courts to be more mindful of those potential downsides of consolidation and to explore other approaches, ones that might be fairer to everyone involved.
It's like they're saying, efficiency is important, yes, but not at the cost of sacrificing fairness or undermining the integrity of the process itself.
Exactly. And this whole theme of balance, it runs throughout the Fifth Circuit's decision in Hardy. They were constantly trying to find that sweet spot where justice is served for both the plaintiffs and the defendants.
Okay, so we've got due process, judicial notice, pluvity, offensive collateral estoppel, the Seventh Amendment, the whole consolidation dilemma, and now this important reminder about the human side of mass tort litigation.
Yeah.
Seems like we've covered just about everything.
We're getting there. But there's one more crucial piece of the Fifth Circuit's analysis we should touch on.
Seriously. I'm starting to think this Hardy v. Johns Manville case is like a legal TARDIS. It's bigger on the inside.
You're not wrong. And this next part, it's particularly relevant for anyone who's interested in that intersection of law and science. The Fifth Circuit really hammered home the importance of scrutinizing the science, especially in these mass tort cases.
Oh, that makes sense. In cases dealing with stuff like asbestos, pharmaceuticals, the science can get really complicated, really fast.
Yeah.
So how did the Fifth Circuit approach that?
They basically said, don't just take scientific claims at face value, even if they come from experts with all sorts of fancy degrees and titles. They emphasized how important it is to really dig into the data, the methodologies, look for potential biases.
So it's not enough to just have a scientist stand up and say, this is dangerous. You have to make sure the science actually supports that claim.
Exactly. They were advocating for this more critical approach, this more skeptical approach to scientific evidence, recognizing that even in areas where the science seems settled, there can still be room for debate, for uncertainty.
And I imagine that's especially important in mass tort cases where the stakes are so high. If the science is shaky, the whole case could fall apart.
That's exactly right. The Fifth Circuit was saying that getting the science right, that's crucial to making sure justice is served in these cases. The legal system can't operate in the scientific vacuum.
Okay, so we've got due process, judicial notice, privity, offensive collateral estoppel, the Seventh Amendment, consolidation, the human impact of litigation, and now this focus on the crucial role of scientific evidence.
I feel like I need a legal dictionary just to keep up.
It's a lot to digest, but it's all intertwined. And believe it or not, there's one last piece of wisdom the Fifth Circuit offered in Hardy.
You're kidding. I'm starting to think this case is the gift that keeps on giving. What else is there?
Well, they talked about the importance of proportionality in legal remedies.
Proportionality. So like making sure the punishment fits the crime, even in civil cases.
Exactly. They cautioned against remedies that are overly broad or sweeping, going beyond what's necessary to compensate victims and deter future wrongdoing. So it's not about seeking revenge or trying to punish companies out of existence. It's about finding a solution that's fair, that is proportionate to the harm that was actually caused.
Precisely. It's about finding that balance between accountability and avoiding those remedies that are excessive, disproportionate, that could stifle innovation or cripple whole industries.
That makes a lot of sense. It's like they're saying we need to hold wrongdoers accountable, yes, but let's not create a system where the cure ends up being worse than the disease.
That's a great way to put it. The Fifth Circuit's focus on proportionality reminds us that the law isn't just about retribution. It's also about finding solutions that promote fairness and balance for everyone.
This idea of proportionality, it adds another layer of complexity to this already intricate case. It seems like the Fifth Circuit was really focused on making sure the legal system finds the right balance, not just between efficiency and fairness, but also between accountability and the need to avoid those unintended consequences.
They were. And their analysis in Hardy has really shaped how courts approach these issues in a lot of different cases, not just asbestos litigation.
I'm really starting to see why Hardy is considered such an important case in the world of mass torts. It's not just about asbestos. It's about establishing this set of guiding principles that can help courts navigate these complex, often messy areas of litigation, ensuring that justice is served for everyone.
Absolutely. And it's a reminder that even in the face of these really tough legal challenges, we can find guidance and wisdom in the carefully reasoned decisions of our courts.
This has been an amazing deep dive. I feel like we've uncovered a whole treasure chest of legal insights and gained a much deeper understanding of just how complicated mass tort litigation really is. But you mentioned there was one more thing.
I did, and it's a big one. Are you ready for the grand finale?
Bring it on. I'm on the edge of my seat. Okay, hit me with it. What's this final gem of wisdom from the Fifth Circuit in Hardy v. Johns Manville?
Well, you know, after they carefully took apart the district court's approach and really laid down the law on due process, judicial notice, privity, all those hurdles, they didn't just stop there. They actually acknowledged how tough these mass tort cases really are. They get it, you know, the need for efficiency, the desire to get those remedies to victims quickly, and the logistical nightmare of dealing with thousands of claims.
It's like they were saying, look, we see the problem, we pointed out the flaws, but we also know there's no easy solution here.
Exactly. And that's where they left us with this challenge, this question that's still relevant today. If the usual tools and methods don't always work for mass torts, what are the alternatives? How do we create a system that can handle these huge, complicated cases without sacrificing fairness or efficiency?
That's a big question. It's like they're admitting the current system has limitations and pushing us to think outside the box.
They are. They weren't pretending to have all the answers in Hardy, but they definitely pointed us in a new direction. They encouraged courts to be creative, to try new procedures, to adapt the legal system to meet these evolving challenges of mass torts.
So Hardy v. Johns Manville isn't just a legal precedent. It's a call to action. It's about recognizing where the current system falls short and challenging ourselves to find better solutions.
Absolutely. It's a reminder that the law isn't set in stone. It has to change and grow with society. And mass torts, they're a perfect example of that. We need to find ways to balance that need for efficiency with protecting individual rights, ensuring justice for victims, but also making sure we're not unfairly burdening defendants.
It's quite the balancing act. It's like trying to solve a Rubik's Cube while juggling chainsaws. But it's a challenge we can't afford to ignore. So where do we go from here? What are some potential solutions to this whole mass tort dilemma?
That's a question for a whole other deep dive. But there are a lot of brilliant legal minds out there tackling this issue, exploring new ways to manage cases, using alternative dispute resolution, even looking at legislative reforms.
I'm definitely going to have to dig into that more. It seems like Hardy v. Johns Manville has opened up a whole new world of legal exploration.
It really has. And it shows the power of a single case to change how we think about the law and inspire new ideas.
Well, there you have it, folks. Our deep dive into Hardy v. Johns Manville has come to an end. We've explored the legal ins and outs, the historical background, and the lasting impact of this landmark case. But as we've seen, the conversation definitely doesn't end here. The challenges of mass tort litigation are still very real, and the search for better solutions continues. We hope you'll keep exploring this topic, stay engaged, and join us as we all work towards a legal system that's both fair and efficient. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.